All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be going through a case, United States versus Salisbury, an 11th Circuit decision.
Wow, going way back.
Yeah, this is from 1981. And we picked this case because it brings up a lot of really interesting things that hopefully will help law students out there who are struggling through their crim pro and evidence classes, thinking about when the government can use recordings of your conversations and what happens if you're claiming you were entrapped. And led to commit a crime you wouldn't have otherwise done. So, it kind of brings together the Fourth Amendment and evidence and this whole idea of entrapment, which is kind of a defense that people are always really fascinated by.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we think about the Fourth Amendment, we think about our privacy interests, and so many cases that we read, come out of this tension, this inherent tension between, law enforcement and prosecutors, trying to get evidence. And then on the other hand, we have all these rights that are supposed to protect us, and how do we strike that balance? And I think this case really brings that tension to light.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of remarkable that, we're talking about a case that deals with something that seems on its face, fairly straightforward, stolen carpets in Tennessee. But, it ends up creating these precedents that we still think about today.
Yeah. And, I think that just goes to show that, in law school, they tell you that, any case could end up being a landmark case. Yeah. And this is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. All right. So let's just let's kind of paint the picture for everyone. So picture Chattanooga, Tennessee in 1980. And the FBI is on the trail of some truck hijackings.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're already in the action.
Yeah, exactly. And their lead comes in the form of, what we see a lot in these types of cases,
mm-hmm.
an informant, a guy named Wright.
Yeah.
And Wright, contacts Richard Salisbury's group. He basically poses as someone who was interested in purchasing stolen carpeting, kind of a classic sting operation set up here.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah. So, a couple of things happen. First of all, Wright starts recording his phone calls with Salisbury's co-defendant, a guy named Hall, and they're discussing this whole carpet deal. And then you have the actual operation itself, $4,500 in exchange for the carpet.
Yeah.
And Salisbury himself is present during the transaction.
Okay.
So it seems pretty, open and shut.
Yeah.
But the prosecution does something else. They introduce evidence that Salisbury had previously tried to sell stolen tires. So kind of trying to paint a picture here of, not just this one instance, but, a history. Of course, Salisbury's convicted 2 counts. And he appeals, arguing, that the recordings, the whole tire incident, shouldn't have been allowed as evidence in the first place.
Okay, so kind of a classic, cry of unfair, right?
Yeah.
The evidence that they use against me shouldn't be allowed.
Right, exactly. So then the case goes up to the 11th Circuit, and Salisbury raises 3 main things on appeal. First of all, he says that the tapes made by the informant, right, shouldn't have been admissible at all. Secondly, he argues that the incident with the tires was irrelevant and prejudiced the jury against him. And then third, he says that this whole tire thing was inadmissible extrinsic offense evidence. So basically, using this past bad act to suggest he's a bad guy who would commit this crime too.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So those are, his 3 main arguments. So let's unpack this, piece by piece, starting with the wiretaps. What was Salisbury's argument against the FBI's recording of these conversations in the first place?
Right. So, it seems like his argument is going to be based on the Fourth Amendment. He probably felt that his conversations, with his co-defendant, he had this reasonable expectation of privacy in those conversations and that these recordings violated that right. It's like picking up your phone and thinking that your conversation is just between you and the other person.
Right. But obviously, the court didn't buy this argument. What was the legal reasoning here that let these recordings be used against Salisbury?
Right. So the key here is the provision of Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, which is 18 U.S.C. Section 25112C. And this provision basically says that recordings made with the consent of one of the parties to the conversation are admissible. So here, since Wright consented to the recording of his conversations with Hall and then later on Salisbury during that sting operation, the recordings were admissible.
So, it seems like basically, if one person is okay with it, then legally it's not really secret anymore.
Yeah. It's sort of this idea that you don't have this reasonable expectation of privacy when you're talking to someone who could potentially be, revealing this conversation to others. And I think, the court said it pretty directly. They said, quote, no expectation of privacy exists when you risk the listener being a snitch. So, it's pretty clear that you know, when you choose to share information with someone, you're taking a risk.
Yeah, you're kind of always gambling on who you're talking to. Now, you also mentioned something about a co-conspirator exception to hearsay. So how did that help get Hall's statements on those recordings into court, even though it's Salisbury who's on trial for this whole carpet scheme?
Yeah. So generally, hearsay isn't admissible in court, but there are some very specific exceptions. And one exception is statements made by co-conspirators during and in furtherance of the conspiracy. So this exception comes from Federal Rule of Evidence 801 Day 2E. And even though, you know, Salisbury wasn't formally charged with a conspiracy, the court could still consider these statements by Hall if there was sufficient evidence that there was a conspiracy and that both Hall and Salisbury were part of it. So basically that these statements that Hall made were in furtherance of this overall conspiracy.
So what kind of other evidence did they need to show that Salisbury and Hall were, you know, in cahoots, that they were in on it together?
Right. So they really looked at Salisbury's own actions. You know, he was physically present at the sting. He was actively participating in this exchange of money for the carpet. So it showed that he was involved in this whole deal that Hall was talking about on the phone. So it wasn't just, you know, relying on Hall's statements, but also showing, you know, Salisbury's actions linked up with that.
Right. He wasn't just a bystander. Okay. So the wiretaps clear that hurdle. Now let's talk about the prior bad act, that whole attempted sale of the stolen tires. Why did the prosecution even bring that up? It kind of just sounds like they're trying to make Salisbury look bad, like a repeat offender.
Yeah. And this is a common argument against, you know, this type of evidence, right? It's very prejudicial. You know, you don't want the jury to, you know, find you guilty just because you've done bad things in the past. But, you know, the law does allow for certain prior bad acts to be introduced. And here, since Salisbury could have argued that he was entrapped, that the government basically tricked him into committing a crime he wouldn't have otherwise committed by raising that defense, he opened the door for the prosecution to try to introduce evidence of his predisposition to commit similar crimes. So basically showing that, you know, he wasn't an innocent person who was, you know, tricked into doing this.
Right. So it's kind of like they're saying, you know, well, actually, you had this tendency, this kind of criminal bent already. And this is where that Beecham test comes into play, right?
Exactly. Yes. And, you know, Federal Rule of Evidence 404B, along with the case United States versus Beecham, you know, lay out the rules for when this type of evidence can be admitted.
Right.
And they look at two things. They look at, you know, is this prior bad act relevant for something other than showing, you know, the defendant's character, you know, that he's just a bad guy. And then second, even if it's relevant, does its probative value outweigh the risk of unfair prejudice to the defendant?
Okay. So in this case, how did the tire incident meet that first requirement? You know, what was it actually proving in relation to this carpet case? What was the connection there?
Right. So here, the tire incident was directly relevant to rebutting this potential entrapment defense. You know, if Salisbury's going to say, well, I was tricked into this whole carpet thing, the prosecution could then point to this prior tire incident to show, well, you know, you've tried to sell stolen goods before, so this isn't a new thing for you. So, you know, it kind of chips away at that whole I was tricked story.
Yeah. So that really highlights the strategic risk of claiming entrapment.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, you're saying, hey, the government made me do it. But on the other hand, you're opening the door for them to say, well, actually, you already had this tendency.
Yeah.
What about the second part of that Beecham test, that whole weighing of the value of the evidence versus the risk of unfair prejudice? I mean, wasn't there a danger that, you know, the jury would just hear, oh, he tried to sell stolen tires, so he must have done the carpet thing, too?
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is, you know, kind of the danger of these prior bad acts, right? And so the court really has to carefully balance, you know, does this evidence actually help us, you know, prove a point, or is it just going to make the jury hate the defendant and think he's, you know, a bad person, regardless of, you know, whether he did this specific crime? And in Salisbury's case, they really looked at the similarity between, you know, these two acts, right? Stolen tires versus stolen carpets. And because both involved, you know, the dealing in stolen goods, they found that it was probative enough of, you know, his inclination towards these types of crimes.
Okay. So they said it was relevant. They said it was more probative than prejudicial. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all that evidence gets in. Now, stepping back a little bit.
Yeah.
What are the kind of big takeaways from U.S. versus Salisbury? I mean, what are the things that law students or really anyone interested in the law should remember about this case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this case really solidified two important legal principles. You know, the first is that, you know, if one party consents to the recording, those recordings are generally admissible in federal court. And this, you know, has huge implications, even in today's world. And then secondly, you know, it really highlights this risk that defendants take when they claim entrapment. You know, by raising that defense, they're basically opening the door to the prosecution to bring in, you know, evidence of their past conduct and to argue that they were predisposed to commit the crime.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, you know, today's world. How would this predisposition thing play out in a, you know, modern case, like let's say a drug trafficking sting or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So imagine, you know, law enforcement is doing a sting operation for drug trafficking and, you know, they arrest someone and this person says, well, I was entrapped. The government, you know, made me do it. Well, then the prosecution can come in and say, well, actually, we have, you know, all these text messages from you talking about buying and selling drugs, or maybe you were previously arrested for, you know, possession or something like that. And so they would try to bring in that evidence to show that, you know, this wasn't some innocent person who was coerced, but that they already had this knowledge and intent to be involved in the drug trade.
It really highlights the lasting impact of this case. And it also reminds me of another case, Jacobson versus United States. In Jacobson, the Supreme Court actually overturned the conviction because they felt that the government had basically put the idea of the crime into the defendant's head and really pressured him, you know, over a long period to do something that he hadn't shown any interest in before. How is Salisbury different from that? Like, what's the key difference there that made Salisbury's conviction stand while Jacobson's was overturned?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think the difference here is that, you know, in Salisbury, the evidence of the prior tire incident showed that there was this existing intent to commit a similar crime even before the government got involved in this whole carpet sting operation. So it wasn't a case where, you know, Salisbury was an innocent person and they, you know, persuaded him to commit a crime. It looked like he already had, you know, this tendency towards, you know, criminal behavior, whereas in Jacobson, there wasn't that predisposition. So the government's actions were seen as the primary cause of, you know, this criminal act.
Yeah. So, you know, in Salisbury, the government wasn't creating a criminal out of thin air, basically. Wow. This has been a really, I think, illuminating look at U.S. versus Salisbury. You know, as we kind of wrap up, are there any other, you know, big questions, big ideas that we should leave listeners with? What are some of the things they should be thinking about after hearing about this case?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this case really brings up a lot of questions about, you know, our legal system and how it operates. You know, how much should past conduct, you know, uncharged conduct really factor into current criminal proceedings? You know, where's the line between showing predisposition and just smearing someone's character? It's a tough question to answer.
Yeah. And it also, you know, makes you think about, you know, in today's world where everything is recorded, everything is digital. You know, if we're thinking about the Fourth Amendment, what does that mean for our privacy in the digital age? You know, if instead of phone calls, Wright had secretly recorded Zoom calls or something back in 1980, would that be, you know, a stronger case for Salisbury that his expectation of privacy was violated? You know, the technology has changed so much since 1981.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes you wonder how these same principles would apply today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think technology is always pushing the boundaries of the law. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how, you know, these principles of, you know, Fourth Amendment privacy and evidence, how they continue to evolve as technology changes.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive. You know, it's a good reminder that even these old cases, you know, still have so much to teach us about the law today. Thanks for joining me.